almost every startup I've talked to in the last 20 years that's made it had a secret go-to-market strategy. They had some slightly subversive act that allowed them to capture the attention of a market at scale in a way that nobody else had thought of. And that turned into the sort of flywheel that let them hit that escape velocity you need as a scale stage company.
That was entrepreneur, author, and event organizer Alistair Kroll, who's the founder of a very interesting business.
I kind of have ADHD as a career. I've been lucky enough to find a way to turn an inability to focus on one thing from a liability into an asset. And my company, much as it is, because it's really just me, is called Solve for Interesting. And the reason for that is that we live in an attention economy, as Herbert Simon said, and we pay attention. Literally, Facebook's valuation is its attention. And when we have too many things to pay attention to, we focus on what's interesting. So all the good things in my life have happened from not solving for fame or risk or wealth or safety, but from solving for interesting.
Today on the show, Alistair and I are going to be talking about this notion of solving for interesting and what that means for businesses as they think about the best way to get people's attention as they go to market. And just to tell you a little bit more about Alistair, since he kind of undersold himself earlier, he's the founder and content chair of Forward 50, an annual conference on the future of government technology. He's also a visiting executive at Harvard Business School and the author of four highly acclaimed books on technology and society, including Lean Analytics. Now, while most of our episodes are about key emerging technology trends and how they affect software companies, every once in a while, we like to explore business strategy and how it affects startups and those organizations that are looking to turn the corner and take their businesses to the next level. Today, Alistair and I will be doing just that. We're going to be talking about go-to-market and product strategies, market alignments, market adjacencies, and some of the different challenges that B2B versus B2C brands face in these areas. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. I'm John Pryle. Welcome to the Impact Podcast.
Alistair Kroll, what a pleasure having you here today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Have you ever seen one of those really cool Dollar Shave Club videos?
I have.
What do you think?
I think they're trying to sell me a razor, but I'm probably not the target market.
Well, leaving your beard aside, what's your thought about them going kind of directly to you? How do you think they go to market strategy aligns with product?
There's no doubt that they can iterate and experiment with people and target pricing and so on. The big change that we've had in information theory in the last 40 years is that media is no longer one-to-many broadcast single message. It's now one-to-one, multicast, two-to-a, many messages. And the ability to tailor and experiment messages means that anybody who is native of an interactive medium is going to iterate on product market fit much faster. And I think Dollar Shave Club is what happens when you do that right.
And our discussion today is much more than kind of A-B testing and marketing in terms of targeting. You've been thinking a lot and written a lot about how you should be taking this learning from your go-to-market and really make sure you've got the right product in place.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental message of lean startup models is your job is to identify the riskiest assumption and then quantify it as quickly as possible. I mean, that's the most, lean doesn't mean you're cheap. Lean means you don't like wasting money. And so if you have five possible risks and you're good enough at guessing the relative importance of those risks, why not spend all your time fixing the first risk or the most significant risk? Because that'll tell you whether you should give the investors back their money. The difference between a B2C and a B2B product is often not talked about, but much of the advice doesn't work in one versus another. If I'm a big company, I would want to do my first sales directly where I was in the room doing the sales because that's how I learn what customers' needs are. So hiring a sales force prematurely can be really dangerous in B2B. But in B2C, by definition, you're scaling by having automated systems engage with your customers. And so analytics is a proxy for what those customers actually want. Chat bots or engaging in chat, talking directly in customer service are good ways to find that out. But in B2C, the whole reason that B2C companies can spring up and scale so fast with few humans is that they are automating the interaction with customers. And I think we've lost one of the primary sources of innovation and iteration that we used to have in that situation.
Now, you mentioned, I think it was in a Startup Amsterdam presentation, I'm sure you've said it in other places as well, that your first product really isn't your end product. Your first product is merely a test case. Is that a fair way to categorize that?
Yeah. In lean analytics, we say you're not building a product. You're building a product to figure out what product to build. People have asked me, what would you have done differently with Coradient, which was a web performance management company I founded? it took us 3 years of running other people's websites as a managed service provider, competing with LoudCloud and SiteSmith, before we realized that the real challenge was understanding what your end users were experiencing. If I had known that, we'd be sitting on my yacht, for starters. I would have delivered value much more quickly.
In terms of capturing information, I know you've talked a bit about Tupperware, and you know they did well with parties versus plastic boxes. Do you see a Tupperware of the future? And I'm making this up now, but everybody shows up in somebody's living room, the salesperson's living room, and is given an iPad. And rather than having a bunch of plastic boxes sitting on the living room table, or maybe having some on the living room table, there's a lot more on the iPad, and we can learn about interactions and product needs and product desires. And my sense is Tupperware doesn't go back to the salesperson and says, hey, what'd you learn? What they're really going to go back and say, hey, what'd you sell?
Right. So I heard a great story from David Ricketts, who's a Harvard professor on innovation. And he said that Kraft had at one point figured out how to powder cheese, which was technically pretty proficient. It didn't spoil. It keeps a long time. And there was a guy in San Francisco trying to sell powdered cheese, and nobody was buying any. And then he thought, you know, I need a way to showcase powdered cheese. I'll go get some pasta. And he attached a box of elbow macaroni to the powdered cheese packet with an elastic band, and it sold like, well, mac and cheese. And today, according to what David says, Kraft sells 1 million boxes of that stuff a day. The salesperson is the one that realized that the product, you didn't just need to have a technology. You had to have it enshrined in a thing that the target market found value. And so David's point is that the elastic band is actually the critical tool there, because it's the thing that literally attaches the technology you have to a value the customer perceives. If you want to think about this in a disciplined way, first of all, I think companies innovate along a range. So there are companies doing sustaining innovation, as Clay Christensen would put it, you know, keep the lights on, next year's Mercedes-Benz kind of thing. Then there's adjacent innovation, where you change either the product or the market or the go-to-market method. For example, Mercedes-Benz selling an electric car. They're still selling it through dealerships. They're still selling it to people who want to own a car, but it's an electric car. Then there's disruptive innovation, which is where you introduce something that changes several aspects of the business model. So Car2Go, for example, which is owned by Mercedes-Benz, the more successful that is, the fewer people buy cars. So it actually destroys the existing business. And then there's this idea of discontinuous innovation, which is sort of underlying societal shifts we can't anticipate, but we got to be ready for. So I would put the self-driving car at the end of that continuum, because that changes a lot of things. There'll be a time in 20 years time when people get used to drive yourself to work. Well, how'd you get any work done? Like that's insane. What if you were drunk? What if you were tired? People won't understand that. And I think when you look at a company like Dollar Shave Club, they're doing adjacent innovation, taking an existing target market and an existing product, but they're changing the go-to-market method. And one of the reasons that we are in this incredible renaissance of innovation and technology companies, you know, none of the companies that were at the top of the stock markets were digital 20 years ago, except maybe Microsoft, and today everyone is because the advent of digital technology has given us the ability to redo the go-to-market method of almost every product that has ever existed.
This is a great discussion on business models. And it's interesting. I'm not sure if, in my mind, Dollar Shave Club is an adjacent market versus a different route to that market. I think a bit about Blue Ocean strategy, which I think was much less about, let's get the product right and let's first understand the market and then find adjacencies and differentiation, which I might be slightly different than Dollar Shave Club, just to be a counterpoint here.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize I have a background in marketing. And so I kind of cringe every time I say there's product, market, and method, because the go-to-market method is intrinsic to the product, right? The order of automatic reorder is your product in the strict definition. But I think if you look at Amazon, when Amazon started, it was a website to sell books to readers. Their innovation was that they did web-based ordering and centralized delivery. So that was a go-to-market method innovation. Later on, using the millions of people that were buying books from them, they could introduce the Kindle, which was a new product sold using a now existent method, i.e. the website, to an existing audience, which was the readers. And then they could sell Audible and they could sell large print Kindle devices and they could target blind people. And that is essentially a new market, the blind or sight impaired. So if you look at that, Amazon has now got, you know, a new market, new product, new method, but they got there a step at a time. And I think that's sort of the lesson of the mac and cheese, is you got to take those iterative steps that eventually get you to the blue ocean. I think there's I almost want to write the Blue Canal book that talks about how you got to find three rivers to get out to the ocean.
As we think about startups, kind of our audience here, startups and growth, you know, companies getting to that point of greater growth, what about startups worrying about getting disrupted as well as being disruptive? How do they think about it? When should they start to think about that?
Startups are often the shoemaker's children. They're very poorly shod, by which I mean that there's a startup that is trying to sell some new technology, some AI or blockchain, but they're reluctant to employ that stuff themselves. They're reluctant to actually use it. And that seems kind of hypocritical. You're telling your customers that the stuff's going to save the world, but you don't want to use it yourself. You're probably missing out on some tremendous opportunities to optimize what you do.
Now, every year you've been running Startup Fest. So what's your message if you were opening the session up and saying, you know, in 2018, here's what we're going to talk about. What are you getting them to think about?
So this year, our theme is infinite possibilities because it's number 8, and 8 on its side looks like an infinity and you need a theme. That's sort of what's on the lid. For a lot of these startups, what I'm trying to get them to think about is to put aside cognitive bias about their startup. Startups run on faith. The chances that you as a founder are going to be successful at the end of it are incredibly unlikely. They're really stacked against you for a whole bunch of reasons, some of them having to do with the privilege of certain groups, some of them having to do with the existing network, a risk aversion of investors, and so on. And there are ways to mitigate that risk to yourself by experimenting with the riskiest thing first, for example, by finding ways to test things at scale. There's a great example I heard a few years ago of a startup whose name escapes me right now, but they wanted to allow you to send gifts via Twitter. Now, let's say that I've met you online and I'm like, I'd really like to send you a present. So I go online, I want to send you a thing on Twitter. So how would I send you a box of chocolates saying, thanks for doing this podcast, this was fun? First thing I got to do is I got to ship it to your house, and you probably don't want to give me your home address. And so the biggest risk there is, will person accept a gift from a stranger on Twitter? It's not, you know, can we ship chocolates? Everyone knows how to ship chocolates. And so they started out with a service that would allow you to send a postcard to someone on Twitter. And you would literally go to their website and say, the postcard is for this Twitter account, and here's the message. And then they'd send that person a tweet saying, hey, so, you know, A. Kroll has sent you a card. Click here to collect it. When you went there, it would ask you for your username and your phone number and whatever else, not your username, but it would ask you for information about yourself, including your phone number. And that phone number would then, you know, they'd be able to call for delivery, and they'd give your address. So you're asking for a lot of personal information. And they did this at first, and a few people tried it, and a few people said yes. And then they kept optimizing the form until more people were comfortable with it, explaining more about how the business worked, or that the sender would never know who you were, and that kind of stuff. And eventually they got the conversion rate up pretty high. At that point, it's pretty easy to say, now I'm going to send roses or boxes of chocolates. But the real risk was, will you provide your address to a website you've never heard of to receive something from a stranger? And the postcard was simply the lowest risk thing you could send. I mean, there's a public message on the side. It costs 50 cents to send. So I think that's a rather long example, but it's a great example of how you look very hard at your business model and de-risk the riskiest elements as cheaply and quickly as possible.
Interesting. Now, if we want to go beyond startups, so we have a startup that's beginning to get traction, they got growth, they got revenue, probably burning a lot of cash, but they're really trying to turn that corner, mature some of the business processes it's running. How would you want those CEOs to think about their business in terms of this kind of lean startup methodology?
So there are two things. First, as I mentioned slightly, a little bit before, you really got to think about two things. You got to think about the product you sell and then your company as the product that is sold. So you got to spend, it's a cliche to say it, but you got to spend a day working on the business for every couple of days you spend working in the business. And as you scale, hopefully you have a management team that lets you do that. I think the other thing is, all the data shows that organizations that embrace metrics do significantly better than those that shoot from the hip and use best what Avinash Kajik calls HIPPO, the highest individually paid person's opinion. The risk, I think, is that the iconoclast of a founder, that person who against all odds believed in the world being a different way, is what got you to this point, this, say, $500,000 a month in revenue and scalable MRR and declining customer acquisition costs, whatever else. And it's very hard to get that person to say, okay, you've now you know, hit escape velocity, that burn away from the planet at all costs, is gone. And now it's time to do much more precise sort of targeting and navigation with small adjustments. Culturally, all the things that were rewarded before you found product market fit can become liabilities afterwards. And so this ability to be honest with yourself about what the big risks are is a very rare attribute that I think startups, as they get to scale stage, really have to think about. I did a talk for Lazaridis Institute a little while ago about orders of magnitude. And I think every time there's an order of magnitude change in the number of employees, the number of customers, or the amount of money, you may have to change your process. If you have one customer, you're employed. If you have 10 customers, you're a small business. If you have 100 customers, you probably start to have like an inbox with support stuff. If you have 1,000 customers, you probably have a full-on customer support desk and so on. Same thing is true if you have, you know, one employee, then you're self-employed. 10 employees, you're a small business. 100 employees, you probably have an HR person. 1,000 employees, you have an in-house lawyer. And at the same time, if you make $1,000 a month, that's probably a hobby or a side business. If you make $10,000 a month, that's your job. $100,000 a month, small business that needs accounting. $1 million a month, you need a CFO. So I think teaching people that it's not about you, it's about these orders of magnitude as you scale is a very good lesson that distances that founding CEO's ego from the problem at hand.
I love the separation and the evolution. And so we think about fine controls. It does come down to data science and decision-making. I think it's fair to say data scientists, again, do a pretty good job targeting or understanding customers. But do you think data science team are spending enough time thinking about kind of evolving the product? What's their alignment with the requirement for an MBA or working with a product management team? What do you think companies are and how should they be evolving as they turn this corner?
I've been teaching a class as a visiting executive at Harvard for a couple of years called Data Science and Critical Thinking. And what I'm pleased about is that, first of all, Harvard recognized the need for this, and the people in the room are really engaged. Many of them are doing civics and politics and stuff as well. It's a real problem. I think the issue of machine learning data bias is one of, first of all, possibility, and then second is about sort of judgment. The possibility stuff is it's hard to tell what's possible. Earlier this week, Google announced Duplex, which allows Google automated agent to call a business and ask questions, have a fully conversational experience. What's amazing to me, like that's cool technology, it's got all kinds of ethical implications and so on. What's amazing to me is nobody was talking about this the day before. Like now everyone's like, oh yeah, of course, Google can crawl humans. Humans are flesh-based APIs. Oh, should the machine have to identify itself? That wasn't on our radar 2 days ago. Like life comes at you fast. And so it's very hard for us to see the world as it could be. Some founders see the world as they'd like it to be. Most of us see the world as it is. And that's true of any data system that is using historical information. If you ask your customers what they want, they'll tell you what they know they want, not what they need. And you'll never build the minivan or the iPad or the Sony Walkman. And so we have to be very conscious that data science is tremendously useful at normative predictions, predictions based on past examples, but it is not very good at formative predictions, meaning how the world should be. And so even when you have the best data science system in the world, the most important management skill is asking the right questions, because then the answers are all around you, but you need to ask those questions first.
Prior to me pushing the record button, you and I were kind of jabbering a bunch of cool stuff. And we were talking about self-driving cars. And you mentioned 20 years from now, someone's going to say, oh my God, how did you get your work done before you had a self-driving car? That is not an issue that shows up in any of the discussions today of self-driving cars.
I'll give you another one. I was on the phone with some folks in the Department of Transportation and FEMA a while ago in the States. They asked me to talk about the impact of technology on resiliency in natural disasters. And, you know, everyone's talking about how neat these things are. And I said, well, in England, a car is parked 93% of the time during the day. I don't have the stats for the US, but that tells me that if you were being efficient, you know, you can get rid of 90% of cars and you still have a surplus. You still have twice as many cars as you need. So if you get rid of 90% of cars, because now we're using a ride sharing service, that's obviously much more cost efficient. And yes, those cars are going to need maintenance more often, but they can take themselves to the shop and so on. So let's say that we get rid of 90% of cars. Then we forget that 90% of cars prediction is spread over time. When you look at a disaster, when everyone needs to get out of the Cascadia subduction zone because the entire West Coast is shaking with an earthquake that's been overdue for 50 years. And there's no cars around. Are you going to stop and like, oh, no, it's okay. I'll use an Uber pool to get out of town with my family and some other families because we didn't have enough cars. So there's a lot of these unintended consequences of technology. Inefficiency is often resiliency. It's inefficient for me to keep water in my house, but if the water goes away, I'm pretty glad I did. And so I think we are going to renegotiate a lot of systems, automated systems that try to make things more efficient by discovering how they break. And we haven't had those things happen yet.
Wow. Yeah, it's interesting. The breaking that we're hearing today on the Ubers and the Lyfts of the world are now cars are driving around and polluting, waiting to pick somebody up. But I hear that. And I go, yeah, but in 5 years, they'll be electric. And that issue is gone.
I did a talk the other day on discontinuous innovation, and I talk about the Great Horse Manure Crisis of 1896, which is a thing. You can go Google it. In London, there were these alarmist headlines in the Times that London would be under 9 feet of manure in a few years. And the numbers are astonishing. I mean, they were killing 65 horses a day were dying on the streets and being let sort of glutify and rot a little bit so rigor mortis would set in so they could cut them up and take them away on horse-drawn carts. And the numbers are astonishing. It's like hundreds of thousands. I did the math on how much manure. It's a horrible number. And of course, there was this meeting in 1898 of the mayors of the world's biggest cities. And the top item on the agenda was how do we deal with the horse manure crisis that we're facing? And they left saying, we have no idea. And by 1912, everyone had a car. So, you know, again, life comes at you fast. And I think the challenge is that the iteration speed for bits is much higher than the iteration speed for atoms. So we run into these very interesting ethical questions. Is if Google knows that when Duplex calls someone and has a conversation with them, they react better if the speaker has the same gender and race as them, which you could learn pretty easily because you can do voice print analysis of those kinds of things. Should the agent change its voice to be the best resulting gender and race to get the response it wants out of the machine?
And maybe not even race, maybe even accent, Southern accent, Midwest accent, New York accent, maybe.
And maybe if it wants to get a provocative answer, it sounds more aggressive. That's a pretty big ethical question, right? We haven't even touched that. I haven't even heard that in the threads about this stuff. And so I think when you look at ethics and data, you have to consider, is the data valid? And there's tons of examples where normative data, which is the norm, is used. A classic example of that, I did a podcast again with David McCraney. He has this amazing podcast, You Are Not So Smart. I had noticed that when you type on your phone, my friend is a nurse, and 2 out of the 3 answers are she, which is a great prediction, or two out of the 3 words that it suggests. It's a great prediction because 87% of nurses are female. So any data scientist would say that's a great prediction. But do we want to reinforce the idea that nurses are female? So is the data biased? Then is the algorithm functioning correctly? And we've seen lots of cases, especially with machine learning algorithms, where they have unintended consequences. Janelle Shange talks about how if you have a picture of a field with white rocks in it, the AI will often say a field full of sheep because it's been trained on pictures of sheep in fields, even though those are rocks. And then if you change the rocks to orange, it says a picture of flowers in a field. Those are good examples of how brittle the model can be. And then finally, you have to say, what is the objective function? If you're playing a video game with Pong or Breakout, the objective function is the score. Nick Bostrom famously says, if you give a superhuman AI the objective function of make paperclips, it'll turn the universe into a giant paperclip factory. He's overlooked the idea that the AI, if it's superhuman, will probably ask itself why it's making paperclips at some point. Those three things, is the data biased? Is the algorithm or the model correct? And is the objective function, the thing we're trying to accomplish, the intended outcome, are the three questions that any executive thinking about how to apply data science to their business needs to consider.
Now, the first one of those is the data bias, I think has to be done. It's critically important. I think we've been talking about that a lot lately in our recent podcast. But you mentioned earlier, kind of one day on the business and 2 days in the business. And my old boss said, look, I spend 50% of my time on strategy and 50% of my time on operations. It sounds like those other two questions require an executive team to step back and really think hard about the big picture is, it's hard to use the term black swan because you can't identify a black swan, but maybe it's a gray swan. You know, what's coming down the pike that you as a company can get ahead of and can take advantage of?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Is the data correct? Is sort of legislated. You have a set of policies you want to reinforce and you apply those rules. Is the model correct? Often requires, and that's more like QA. So in Boston, for example, the city of Boston rolled out an app called Street Bump, which you put on your phone and put it in the passenger seat next to you. And on the way to work, it measured where all the potholes were, which was, the data was fine. Data was fine. Data was great. It showed you where all the rich white people's potholes were because they're the ones that drove themselves to work with an unlimited data plan and the passenger seat next to themselves. And so the data was fine. The model was biased. Then it took a human looking at the map of where the potholes were to go, hey, those are all the rich neighborhoods. And then they attached the sensors to school buses and garbage trucks and they got good data.
What a great point to sum up where we've gone, where we're going. From thinking about the market, operating a business as it grows, to what we at the Impact Podcast love so much, getting the data right. Alistair Kroll, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
This was great. Yeah, I really enjoyed chatting.
Thanks for listening. If you like what we're doing, we'd appreciate your telling other people about the show. Better yet, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or write a review. Doing so will really help ensure that more people can find us. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the Impact Podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you go to find your podcasts.